there's a war that's about to begin. It's gonna get meaner than a Texas high wind.
Calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is White Aryan Resistance. Tom Metzger right here. Terrible Tommy in the bunker right here on the 18th of November, 2014, Tuesday. And I'm telling you, it's colder than a well digger's heel around here this morning. It's about 10 degrees. And we got a wind chill factor. It's about a 30 mile an hour wind, and it'll freeze your ass off if you go outside. So I'm going to stay right here in the bunker all day, if possible. And we are at P.O. Box 401. Yep, still there. Yeah, if you reach way back in that box, you'd grab a hold of my neck. Okay, and it's P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana. And I hope my dish doesn't freeze up for the getting this show out today. Well, man, the only thing that's happy around here is my dog. My Siberian Husky couldn't wait till this kind of weather got here. She goes out and lays in the snow half a day, sitting out there on the porch. She don't want to be inside. She loves that cold weather. Well, let's see what the hell's happening today or yesterday or maybe way back. Never know, I might crawl back into my Wayback Machine and do some history today. I don't know. You know, we got a Senator Bernie Sanders up there in Vermont or Maine, I believe it is. He's pretty good on the money boys. He goes after the billionaires. But one thing he doesn't tell you, that he is all for the military appropriations bill. He votes all the time for the big military budgets. So some liberal he is. The old Huffington Post, about as far progressive as you can get. They banned me from even responding to their information that they put out. The Huffington Post, that bitch from, where's she from? Czechoslovakia or some Eastern European country? Came over here as a fresh new whore and married this Huffington out in California, who had a lot of money. And she stayed with him a little while and divorced him and took all his money, and now she's trying to be Mrs. USA, Miss USA. And she doesn't even drop his name. If he had any balls, he'd take her to court, tell her to quit using his name. Anyhow, they got a story in here about a 29-year-old corrections officer in Ferguson, Missouri, who was accused of raping a pregnant woman who was supposed to be able to leave jail. Now, they don't say a white corrections officer, because this could very well be a nigger. The federal lawsuit against Jairus Hayden, which doesn't sound like a black, normal black name, but it could be, accuses him of ordering the woman into the boiler room of the city jail in October 2013 and ordering her to provide oral sex before forcing himself upon her. You mean he raped her? Hayden allegedly assaulted the woman, even though her boyfriend had posted her bail, telling her, "You're the type of girl that could get me in trouble," as he released her from her cell. According to the lawsuit, DNA analysis confirmed that the pubic hair the woman obtained during the attack belonged to Hayden. Quote, "Law enforcement officers of the city of Ferguson have been involved in many other acts of violence, including the shooting of Michael Brown." Well, they don't talk about the violence cops perpetrate on white people. The suit states, "On information and belief, discovery will produce other acts of violence, all contributing to a pattern of practice allowing violence and sexual assault on members of the public." Duh. I mean, this happens all over the country. I mean, it just all of a sudden they want to dogpile Ferguson, Missouri. "The numerous acts of violence against the citizenry by law enforcement of the city of Ferguson constitutes a pattern." Well, that's okay to expose that kind of stuff, but you're not exposing the pattern by niggers all over St. Louis and Ferguson raping, pillaging, in all the things that they do. I mean, if you're going to be a progressive, be a fair progressive. There isn't any comparison, even though I'm not a big friend of a lot of cops, but I'm not going to overdo it either, because there are a lot of bad cops. But when they when these so-called progressives like Huffington rail and just pile it on one segment of society, primarily white, and never really talk about the widespread numbers of rapes and torture and everything committed by niggers. So you can take that for what it's worth. I don't have a dog in a fight. I hope you don't either. Either side. If a cop's decent to me, I'm decent to him. And if a nigger's decent to me, I'm decent to him. But you know as well as I do that a majority of the Negro race don't operate in our best interests. So, and most cops don't operate in our best interests. And I've got a history to prove that. So anyhow, they're dogpiling the cops down there in Ferguson, but I can't wait till they come out with in other words, I think they're going to prosecute this guy because they're scared to death. All the businessmen and all the, everybody around and all around and the nigger mayors and all that, we got to get him, you know. And so they'll have probably everybody on the grand jury was scared to death. My God, you know, well, I had the same situation in Portland. All the people on that jury saw all the cops and everybody with machine guns all over the place and people marching in the street and scared the shit out of them. So they voted the way they voted. Anyhow, get your popcorn ready because it's liable to be an interesting next few days. I noticed it's pretty cold out there in Ferguson like here. And I didn't see near as many niggers out there. They're dressing up like Santa Claus out there. They don't like that cold weather. A lot different in the summertime, in the fall, when they can wear the shorts and T-shirts or no shirts and come out there by the thousands. But when it gets down like it was this morning, 10 degrees, probably that cold in Ferguson, Missouri, the Negro rioters tend to back off a little bit. I had an email from one of our associates, one of our subscribers, or whatever you want to call us, lone wolves, about he was surprised that I reverted from white separatism to white supremacy. Well, I don't know. I read a book, and I'm going to share some of it with you sometime, from 1945, and he makes it very clear. He makes it as clear as someone who's got a pretty good education can make it, that it's just us against the rest, the white race against the rest, which Ben Klassen surely understood. And I used to be critical of that. I felt, well, we can work it out, we can make a deal, we can have separate areas. But I found out after attempting to negotiate with other races for 25 years or better, it goes nowhere. They're not interested in it. They're sure in their mind they're going to get it automatically. It's just going to fall into their lap. They don't give a shit about it. And we're fools, and I've been a fool to a degree by thinking that we could ever work this out peaceably, because it's not going to be worked out peaceably. So I got to go back to the boys early on in this country when they called it white supremacy. And when my good friend J.B. Stoner, who's now passed away, used to get up and rail and talk about white supremacy and the niggas, and I used to cringe because I was back in the beginning when I first started out, and I thought, well, we could talk nice to these people and get along. Let's just get along, right? Bullshit. Ain't never going to work, never did, and so white supremacy, and if they're going to call us white supremacists, do like the Quakers did. It was an insult to call them Quakers, but they They took it on and said, bullshit, okay, we're Quakers. Tell all those white nationalists, that old Metzger has reverted to his true self. He's a white supremacist. A racial socialist white supremacist. There you go. Well, I'm telling you, this, you know, there's a song, The Party Goes On Forever. This Mo, I forget her last name, the nigger, this high yellow, this mulatto broad, who's not that well-educated, that came over here and talked me into an interview, which I'm going to regret to my grave, because she included me with a lot of the Hollywood Klan and all that and called me a right-winger. She didn't write down what I said at all. So anyhow, but Germany is just eating her up. They're going to make her maybe the next president of Germany. Yeah. She just, they're playing her show and her documentary on every website, every TV station, movies, in the theaters, all over Germany. You'd think she was the coming Jesus. Jesus is here, and she's black. Every day I get these reports on the internet from all over the world, and I just get dozens and dozens. They're just falling all over themselves over this nigger broad. Jesus. Never again, as the Jews say this time, never again. I ain't going to do no more documentaries. It don't do us any good. Well, a climatologist is saying now that he thinks this weather pattern of extreme cold is here to stay for decades to come. In fact, Casey, a former space shuttle engineer and NASA consultant, is out with the provocative book Dark Winter, How the Sun is Causing a 30-Year Cold Spell, which warns that a radical shift in global climate is underway and that Al Gore and other environmentalists, he says, have it completely wrong. I think I saw this guy on TV. The Earth, he says, is cooling and cooling fast. And unless the scientific community and the political leaders act soon, cold, dark days are ahead. That sort of goes along with that movie I watched, The Snowpiercer. And that's what happened. I mean, it really froze up. Casey says the evidence is clear that the Earth is rapidly growing colder because of diminished solar activity. He says trends indicate we could be headed for cold temperatures similar to those seen in the late 1700s and early 1800s, when the sun went into a solar minimum, a phenomenon that significantly reduced solar activity, including solar flares and sunspots. If he's right, that would be a very bad news. Well, it depends. Does the extreme cold benefit the white race or the black race or the races in between? Dark Winter posits that a 30-year period of cold has already begun. Frigid temperatures and food shortages that inevitably result could lead to riots and chaos. Well, does that fit into our box of weaponry? I think so. I've talked about chaos before, to the chagrin of my buddy Bob that used to do the show with me. Chaos is needed, and the more chaos, the more confused the other races get, and our race tends to be more level-headed and logical. I'm not talking about the general population. I'm talking about those at the top of the pyramid, you know. Casey tells Newsmax, all you have to do is trust natural cycles and follow the facts, and that leads you to the inevitable conclusion that the sun controls the climate and that a new cold era has begun. Casey is the president of the Space and Science Research Corporation, an Orlando, Florida climate research firm. Well, I was listening to a guy somewhat like this quite some time back, and I thought it was pretty assured that it was going to get colder, and then they keep pushing this global warming, and pretty soon you get confused. But anyhow, there's nothing you're going to do about it much. Any major thing you can't do, so you're just going to have to prepare yourself either by a whole shitload of Bermuda shorts if it's global warming, or buy yourself a whole shitload of alpaca parkas and feet Joni hand warmers.
Fight against what is either real or still to some junk science, climate change. Welcome back to Midpoint. President of the Space and Science Research Corporation, a leading independent climate research firm, a former White House space program advisor, also author of a book I heartily recommend, Dark Winter, How the Sun is Causing a 30-Year Cold Spell. John Casey joins us in the studio. John, pleasure to see you again.
Ed, good to be back.
I don't think people have quite gotten this whole thing about the 30-year cold spell yet, but I think we're going to introduce them to it if they haven't heard it already. First of all, let's start right out at the top. The president cuts a big deal with China. Everybody's talking about it. It is exactly what the world needed, according to some. I can already guess by your reaction, as I've heard from many before, that this doesn't mean much and it's not going to really last.
That's correct. Exactly. The deal with the Chinese is certainly good PR and supports the environmental base of the president. But when you get down, boil away the top layer and see what's beneath, there's not a lot for the U.S. except more economic distress by higher prices for utilities. And if you look at the Chinese side of it, they're making out like bandits. They get to produce as much CO2 as they want, build as many coal-fired power plants as they want for the next 16 years. It's clearly a lopsided agreement, if it were a necessary agreement at all.
Then hit me with some common sense here, because if it is as bad as you say, and some of the experts have said, why did we cut this deal? What could possibly be the positives here?
Well, on the president's side, as we all know, he's taken a lot of hits on the international stage. This is the one venue where he could elevate his presidency and perhaps his legacy, which is 2 years away. So he's working on that already. So clearly an international agreement with the number one country in the planet, and certainly for the future, is a big step up for him. However, if you look at other things that are going on, I think that he's also trying to get his party prepared for the election in 2 years, and an international agreement of this scope supposedly would help there, too.
Wouldn't we be a lot smarter, and the president be a lot smarter, if he was getting us ready for what you detail in your book, Dark Winter, and that is the fact that it's going to get colder. This is a global cooling issue that we're involved in here, and this is the sun that is involved. Wouldn't it be a lot smarter if we got ready for that?
Absolutely. I mean, the facts are pretty clear. There is no global warming yet. We've had no growth in global temperature whatsoever for 18 long years now. Now, that's a startling fact, but it's true. And what that means is for most of the time we've heard about man-made global warming, there hasn't been any.
Then why do we continue to hear the phrase global warming? Why does it exist?
There are two components to all of this, the politically correct version of climate change and the scientific factual reality of climate change. They are not the same. They are diametrically opposed. By using the greenhouse gas theory since 1988, the U.S. and other nations around the world have been able to impose new regulations, new controls over people, their property, and the industrial base. When you do that using the greenhouse gas theory, you can get a lot of things done, including taxation, that you couldn't get done before. On the science side, however, the sun is the supreme ruler of climate, and it's doing something totally different.
Then why does science always lose in this PR battle to get the message out?
When it comes to power politics, the scientists have always lost. In this case, the scientists pushing CO2 have been tools for the political establishment to get their agenda going. And unfortunately, a lot of scientists have gone over to that side, the dark side of climate science. And instead of the bright side, the truthful, factual side, they're not telling the people the truth about what's happening with the sun.
This matter of being ignorant on the president's side, or just wanting to push something to make somebody else a couple of bucks?
Well, I can tell you from my perspective,
please,
The president, since he began running, has been well informed of what's happening with the sun and this new cold climate. Clearly, a lot of people know what's going on. We all use the same satellites. We all observe the same sun. There's really not a lot of question about what's happening with the sun.
Hold that thought, because we're going to come back and do a lot more. After the break, more with John Casey.
Well, there you go, boys and girls. Which way you want to go? You want to buy a bunch of Bermuda shorts and for up in North Dakota? Or do you want to get some fur coats, like my mother used to wear a sealskin coat, one of her favorite items. And since she didn't have a lot of money, probably the only real cool item she could afford. So anyhow, it's up to you. Make up your mind. Top story. I think we covered this before when it initially happened. There we go. My audio was down a little bit. I don't know why that was. The family of a Texas college student gunned down outside his apartment by a campus police officer said authorities have ignored and refused to turn over key evidence in their response to a lawsuit. Autopsy results show 23-year-old Cameron Redis was shot 5 times at close range by Corporal Christopher Carter, a University of Incarnate Word police officer, during an early morning December 6 traffic stop near the San Antonio campus. The shooting gained national attention after the witnesses reported that the officer never warned Redis before emptying his gun on the student after he made a derisive remark. Quote, I heard the student say, oh, you're going to shoot me, like sarcastic almost, said a witness. So anyhow, there you go. Make up your mind. Are those policemen out of control, or are they not? Well, here's another cop story. A New Jersey police officer was caught on videotape exposing himself to young men during at least 5 traffic stops, authorities said. What the hell is it with these guys? Jason R. Miller, a Newton police officer in New Jersey since 2001, was charged with 2 counts of second-degree official misconduct. One count of third-degree showing his pattern of official misconduct and disorderly person's offense of lewdness, reported the New Jersey Herald. Police opened their investigation late last month after receiving an anonymous email tip from a man who claimed the 37-year-old cop Miller had exposed himself or during a traffic stop. In other words, he took his pecker out of his pants and waved it around. Let's talk straight on this show. We don't want to beat around the bushes. Exposed himself. Well, he was exposed. He was standing right in front of these guys. Anyhow, Newton police and detectives from the prosecutor's office examined video from the traffic stop and tracked down the tipster who told him he was stopped October 23rd after leaving a pub about midnight. Miller took the 22-year-old man's paperwork back to his cruiser, the man said, and returned to notify him that he would not be issued a ticket. However, the man said he noticed the officer's zipper was down and his genitals were exposed. Jeez, what the hell's going on? He told a friend about the encounter, and the friend claimed the same thing had happened to him after he was stopped by a Newton police officer. The 23-year-old friend told police during their investigation that he was stopped while driving a friend home. The officer asked the driver if he noticed his zipper was down. The man said no. The driver was allowed to leave and dropped off his friend. Oh, jeez. What the hell? Talk about an insane asylum. Where are they getting these recruits to be cops from? I think the cops should have their own official whorehouse down there next to the police station to keep these guys under control, man. I'll tell you, getting out of hand here. I'm speaking facetiously, of course. Well, this global warming thing's heating up again. Here's another thing on it that I dug up. Imagine for a moment sitting in a prestigious steakhouse in Palm Beach, Florida, a hot spot for some of the most wealthy and famous, Donald Trump, Tiger Woods, Tiger Woods, Oprah Winfrey, James Patterson, Rush Limbaugh, Scumball, and hundreds more. And imagine dining with a handful of men you've only read about. Some of them are worth millions, others published best-selling books, and some have held prominent positions at the White House, the Black House. In essence, you're sitting at a five-person table of VIPs. You're about to take a bite of your New York strip steak when one of the men atop U.S. intelligence agent slams a 164-page document in the middle of the table. This document, you will soon find out, contains damning evidence that a network of politicians, corporations, and scientists have conspired together to promote the fear of global warming, despite evidence clearly stating no such global warming exists. The motive? $22 billion a year. To be clear, that's $22 billion of taxpayers' money, the amount that our government pays to stop the global warming epidemic. Oh, boy, here we go. That comes out to $41,856 every minute. Or to put it in perspective, that's twice as much as what our government spends on securing our borders. Then imagine this top U.S. intelligence agent turning to you and asking for you to join him on a mission to out those involved in the global warming lie. Doing so would cost a lot of money, a lot of time, and could cost you your reputation. But pretending you never saw the document and carrying on with your life would allow the scandal to continue and actually put lives at risk. So imagine if you were at that table and the scenario I just described happened to you. Well, and Gore is hopping mad, Mr. Gore, because they're poking holes in his global heating program. Now, obviously, this argument would benefit the oil and coal business. You got to look under every rock when you read this stuff, because if they can say that there is no global or there is global warming, that helps the people who want to get rid of using coal and oil. But if it's the other way around, that's going to help the coal and oil business. Because, you know, if the temperatures go real low, you're going to be burning a lot of coal. We'll probably be going back to coal stoves like we had when I was a kid. I used to have to chop the wood and haul the coal in from out back of the house and put it in our stove right in the middle of our living room. So it's going to be a very interesting ride, all this stuff coming out now. You're going to have to choose which side you're on, or which side is right, I guess. Yeah. Me, I'm hedging my bets. Well, here's a guy who took the natural law into his own hands. A Georgia man avoided jail as part of a guilty plea in the fatal shooting of a man who happened to be a Mexican or something. It's one of those countries who pulled in his driveway by mistake. Well, we don't know that. He's dead. Philip Saylors admitted that he came out of his Lilburn home shooting January 29, 2013, after spotting a strange car in his driveway. 70-year-old white man fired a warning shot in the air and then a second shot through the car's windshield after he claimed the driver accelerated toward him. However, police said evidence showed the car was leaving Saylor's property when he fired the shot that killed 22-year-old Rodrigo Diaz. Three friends with Diaz were handcuffed and arrested after the shooting although they had committed no crimes, but Sailors was not handcuffed or taken into custody. Well, that's good. Yeah, his attorney said he would have used police handling of the case to show Sailors was justified in his fear of a home invasion and the case had gone to trial, which probably would have been. A carload of Mexicans pull in your driveway? Yeah, I don't know whether to be shooting at him, but I would be ready to shoot at him, I'll tell you that. I don't think anybody should go to the door if there's strangers coming around your place without a gun. And pepper spray, too. Not that I want to see trigger-happy people shooting anybody that comes down the street, but it's better to have one than not have one. Living out here in the country like I do, and my neighbors are quite a ways off. If I saw four or five Mexicans in a car pull up to my front gate, you better believe I'd be armed until I saw what was going on. Well, let's get back into our Exiles from History by David McCollum. We left off with all this Freudian stuff. I think, yeah. Marcuse, the Red, eventually patched together all his criticisms of the Neo-Freudians into a book entitled Eros and Civilization. Marcuse argued that the revisionists continued to espouse the idealistic values which rationalized the exploitation and alienation characteristic of capitalism. This was reprehensible, first of all, because it was utterly arbitrary in a theoretical point of view. Another example of the theoretical shabbiness of revisionism. Moreover, the special content of revisionist ethics was the old roster of Protestant capitalist virtues. Productivity, achievement, responsibility, respect for one's fellow man, inner strength and integrity. Fromm revives all the time-honored values of idealistic ethics as if nobody had ever demonstrated their conformist and repressive features, unquote. Paul A. Robeson, who wrote The Freudian Left in 69, the term Protestant capitalist or Protestant work ethic has long been a code for WASP among intellectual Jews, ever since the days of Max Weber, who argued that Protestantism was the cause of capitalism. Jews have been trying to muddy the waters by making out that usury and productivity are the same thing. Capitalism. In actual fact, they are opposites. Productivity is hampered by usury. Usury is a parasite on the back of productivity. The Weber thesis was long ago exploded by the German thinker Werner Sombart, who argued that die Juden und das, well, I can't pronounce it, that it was actually the Jews who were responsible for the pyramid growth of usury capitalism. Robeson goes on in his description of Marcuse's Eros book. Quote, Marx was clearly the unacknowledged hero of Eros and Civilization. That Marcuse never mentioned Marx's name in the book was an extraordinary feat of legerdemain. It is my contention that the underlying tactic of Eros and Civilization was to bring Freudian theory into line with categories of Marxism. Marcuse, his main argument appears to be that capitalist society suppresses sexuality and thereby perpetuates and creates neurosis. Sexual liberation, including the resexualization of the body instead of just the genital area, would go hand in hand with economic liberation. While Marcuse was a professor at the University of California at Berkeley, he took full advantage of his position to agitate the students in favor of the sexual and political revolution which he sought. The death of Wilhelm Reich and Erich Fromm and the passing of Marxism from the realm of campus fads has meant that an entirely new generation of therapy gurus has sprung up since the old gang of the Frankfurt School. The trend seems to be away from the intellectual, economic, reductionist philosophies and towards the hedonistic, me-centered attitudes of the 70s and 80s. Although the approach may differ, the game remains the same. Just as in the old days of the 50s and 60s, the new messiahs, or new psychological yentas, who have followed in Freud's and Frankfurter's footsteps, are busy telling us that we suffer from their problems and need to pay them a handsome retainer so they can tell us all about it. One of the most dramatic of the new therapies is Primal, with all of the panache of Hollywood hype merchant, the developer of Primal Therapy, Dr. Arthur Janov, readily boasts that he is flooded with applications from around the world for his $6,000 courses in learning to cry like a baby. Janov claims, just like the early Freud, that patients suffer from an unhappy reminiscence of infanthood. Only by returning to the infant state and reliving these times can a patient be cured. So profitable is Primal Therapy that a whole gaggle of imitators have sprung up around the country, only to be slapped with copyright infringement suits by Janov. He regularly publishes warning notices in popular trade magazines such as Psychology Today. Primal Therapy caters to and is run by those who feel dominated, castrated, unloved, and controlled by their mothers. The emphasis is on the pain of infanthood, not the joy. All in all, there could be no better encapsulation of Jewish trauma than this almost totally Jewish cult. There have been many imitators of Janov. The most prominent is undoubtedly Dr. Daniel Kasriel, who offers scream therapy at a much cheaper price tag. He too holds that childhood revolves around pain and insists that all patient statements should be prefaced by the delightful, homely, fuck you. Wait a minute. I can't believe I'm reading it. One of the most, the more populous neo-Freudians was Dr. Eric Byrne, who took Freudianism off the couch and into the parlor with his pulp paperbacks, Games People Play, and What Do You Do After You Say Hello? His protege, Tom Harris, continues today in the same vein with his transactional analysis workshops based on his cheery book, I'm Okay, You're Okay. Therapy involves Dale Carnegie-style pep talks and TA parlor games, such as one entitled Schlemiel. One of the more widely known therapies is Gestalt, a German word meaning configuration. I remember when Duke got off into some of this stuff. He paid a lot of money to go down to Palm Springs and sit all day. That was not the name of it, but this guy, this guru, had this thing going, and they locked him in. They couldn't even get out of there to go to the bathroom. I sent a guy over there to see what was going on, and he reported back to me that Duke had paid, I don't know how many thousand dollars to go through this course. Gestalt was dreamt up by the late Fritz Perls and his wife Laura. Perls dismissed orthodox psychoanalysis as mind-fucking and instead practiced feeling instead of thinking. It was Perls who coined the 60s slogan, do your own thing. Therapy involves group counseling sessions to encourage the patient's awareness to discourage. Oh, I remember what that deal was Duke got into. It was called EST. And EST was run by this Jew, and I forget his name, but he was taking in a lot of money on this EST cult. And like I say, Duke was over there in Palm Springs following that stuff. He couldn't get out to pee. Patients and therapists are encouraged to touch each other. Awareness of feelings and display of them is the key to healing. Perls, despite the intellectualism of Freudianism, which he would refer to as elephant shit. But Perls himself was originally a traditional Freudian analyst in Germany, where he worked with Wilhelm Reich. After spending the war years in South Africa, he came to the United States in the 1950s, where his me-centered therapy arrived just in time to exploit the increasingly hedonistic, anti-intellectual groundswell that would sweep the country from west to east. There have been many spin-offs from Gestalt, which are known generically as the Human Potential Movement or the Humanistic Psychology. There is Carl Rogers, who transferred Pearl's group counseling sessions into the one-on-one situation. There is Mike Murphy, a layman who inherited a large estate at Big Sur and figured that weekend encounter groups would pay the bills each month, hence that was Esalen. Then there are lesser prophets in the therapy temple, Paul Bindrim of Nude Encounter, Bill Schultz, the Messiah of Joy, and the guru of humanistic psychology, Abraham Maslow. All of these philosophies offer self-actualization for the individual, salvation from the lifelong unhappiness and futility, and escape from loneliness into ready-made, off-the-peg, family-style encounter groups. Much of the marketing technique is disturbingly similar to hot gospel flim-flam artists of the Bible Belt, Orange County, and Sunday evening television. Even the United States government falls for this quackery. Many federal departments have programs whereby personnel may attend sensitivity training sessions. Sensitivity training, or T-groups, was invented by the late Kurt Lewin, yet another refugee from Nazi Austria. The Kindred Encounter groups were the brainchild of J.L. Moreno, also a Jewish refugee from Austria. If one had to choose a top-of-the-line winner in quackery stakes, it would be impossible to decide between Est and Scientology. Well, there's Est. Yeah. I don't know what Duke got out of that. Est was founded in 1971 in San Francisco by Werner Hans Erhard. He adopted this pseudonym in mid-flight between St. Louis and San Francisco after leafing through a copy of Newsweek and reading an article about a German rocket scientist working at Cape Kennedy. His true name was Jack Rosenberg. Originally, Est stood for Erhard Seminar Training, but with a change of the market strategy, the expanded title was dropped altogether. It is now claimed that Est is taken from the Latin for it is. S training ostensibly operates without theory, but in actually combines all the most exploitive gimmicks of both traditional and humanistic therapies. The training takes place in a large hotel suites or convention centers over two weekends. Yeah, that's what it was down there in Palm Springs. I laughed my ass off when Wyeth Kaldenberg and another guy came back from Palm Springs because they went down there and got into that too, and they told me about it. During the session, the attendees are refused permission to go to the bathroom or to eat or to take notes. See, that's what I said. Duke couldn't get out to pee. Attendees are treated like performing seals. During the first sessions, they are ridiculed and often called assholes. Well, If the term fits, I mean, I don't know. Later sessions involve sharing or telling others about oneself and one's problems. Well, hell, any bartender could do that and cost you but a few drinks. A catharsis typical of almost all therapies, then processes or play-acting exercises to simulate anger, fear, like, etc., are organized. A technique lifted from Gestalt and Scientology. See, there you go with Scientology. A lot of people I've known got into that, too, and they were supposed to be revisionists, where the revisionist center there in L.A. Had a whole bunch of those people operating the Institute for Historical Review. In fact, Tom Marcellus was a sort of a big shot in Scientology and was recruiting a lot of people who came in there for the IHR thing into Scientology. So anyhow, after several days of insult, discomfort, and boredom, the trainees are finally expected to get it. It is no more than the acceptance of oneself as an all-capable, all-loving individual without hang-ups or blockages. A state that sounds awfully similar to Dale Carnegie's 1960s self-confidence seminars. It's interesting how a lot of things you cross paths in this struggle with different crazy stuff that people get off the main road and off into the weeds. S graduates are prevailed upon to bring their friends and family to the final evening session, which coincidentally is also a sales session for the new people. Curious about the trainees' account of what took place, these new folk are battered with a two-hour sales pitch that would put a door-to-door encyclopedia salesman to shame. A salesman promises that a process will be organized so they see what it is all about, but for some reason this never takes place. During an interval towards the end of the 2 hours, the neophytes are lobbied by always smiling Estians, mostly volunteers, to sign up for the $350 course. An array of credit card machine walls them in. Oh, man. Let's see here. Meanwhile, Werner Erhard, the Hans, has disappeared, along with the Rosenberg, lives a life of luxury in Marin County, raking in the shekels from his pyramiding operations, where every single printed piece of paper is a copyright Werner Aaron in discrete type. Over 100,000 Americans have graduated from this used car salesman's Est courses. There's where a lot of your Klan membership money went out there if you were in the Klan at the time. Duke was putting it into into the Est movement. One of his staunchest advocates is Est graduate and folk singer John Denver. No wonder he got fucked up. I like John Denver too. I wonder if that had something to do later on with his committing suicide. The Church of Scientology. I investigated the Church of Scientology, including, I worked with David McCollum on that, and I took an airplane. My friend took me up there. They had a ranch out there in Riverside County. They were building a big center there, and I imagine it's still there. And from the air with binoculars, I could see hundreds of white people down there working like niggers. Working on the grounds of this place. I saw only white people working like slaves. The Church of Scientology is perhaps the most anti-establishment of all the therapy faiths, established as a church primarily to gain taxation advantages. Yeah, Ben Klassen tried that too, and I told him, you'll never get it. None of our people have ever got tax exemption. The Scientologists find themselves in continual battles with federal and state governments. Several Scientologists have been convicted of burglaries into state offices and harassment of state officials. Well, that's because it's a cult. These are all cults. Scientologists are prominent in the tax rebel movement. Well, I was too, but not with them. But the purpose of all this rebellion is not libertarian, individualistic freedom. The purpose of Scientology seems to be the enriching of the corporate coffers through milking the faithful of every spare dime. Now, remember that the author of this book, David McCollum, was involved in the Institute for Historical Review, and he knew Tom Marcellus, and he knew all these Scientologists who had infiltrated Willis Cardo's operation. Yeah. The cult was dreamed up by science fiction writer L. Ron Hubbard. Today, Hubbard heads a worldwide religion with outposts in almost every English-speaking country in the world. No wonder the English-speaking country of the world is fucked up. And a headquarters church in rolling South Downs in Sussex, England, at East Grinstead. Hubbard himself is a recluse until recently, living on board a yacht that is perpetually at sea. I don't blame him. There's a lot of those people got all pissed off. They got sucked into that cult. They want to kill him. Predicted on his early book, Dianetics, copyright L. Ron Hubbard, of course, Scientology courses involve counseling or auditing sessions where the trainee answers an auditor's questions while holding onto an e-meter or lie detection machine, and it's a very simple, crude machine. I'm very familiar with these machines, and I can build one in about a half an hour, and they don't really tell you much. Nothing that I would go to the bank with. The auditor points out the flaws in the trainee's personality and helpfully suggests Scientological courses that might remedy this for a few $100. Since many of these courses cost hundreds and even thousands of dollars when you get close to the top, the trainees are encouraged to go into debt through the bank loans and so on in order that they might save themselves in these courses. Well, that's similar to, what's his name that ran for president? LaRouche. Yeah, that's what LaRouche did. He had these guys all getting people putting donations on credit cards, and he built a giant war chest doing that, you know. And there was one guy who was one of his security men, Roy Frankhauser, who had been a well-known neo-Nazi, and a Hollywood Nazi, and a Klansman back in Pennsylvania. And he used to call me once in a while. I don't know whether he was trying to pump me for information or what. And let's put it this way. He called me one time because they were going to arrest LaRouche, and they're going to arrest all these guys. And he was his security guy, and he had told me he'd lied to LaRouche a lot and set up phony deals to expose plots against LaRouche that never even were real. But he said, hey, Tom, they're picking us up. We've all been indicted and so forth. Should I rat on LaRouche? I said, you took his money, didn't you? He said, yeah. Well, you lived pretty well on that money, didn't you? Yeah. Well, then you shouldn't rat him out. And I don't know. I think he didn't. But, when you work with somebody and you're loyal to them, you take their money, you don't rat them out. That's my position. Anyhow, Frankhauser died a few years ago. Okay, needless to say, the whole process is a perpetual motion machine where the trainees can complete enough units so that they too can become an auditor. And perhaps eventually, even a guardian who polices the church for heretical tendencies. I understand rumors are that they get pretty rough, some of these people. They put a lot of even physical pressure and put the hurt on people in this Scientology cult. All cults do that. I mean, all cults. Catholic cults, Protestant cults, Mormon cults, Islam cults. They all get power and then they get they push themselves around. And if you get in their way, they'll mess with you. That's why you're better off to be a lone wolf. So what do we make out of the therapy industry? Is it no more than a boondoggle, a cute way to making money without working too hard? Is it a Californian version of the Deep South's sorry Sunbelt's Marjo's? Now remember Marjo, that he was a kid, he was almost a preteen preacher. Down south, he was a Jew, and he gained national notoriety. He made a fortune off the boobs as this young evangelists, mostly in the Bible Belt. They even made a movie about him. I forget what the title was. Are all these laid-back, hip, tanned, relaxed, cosmopolitan Californians falling for the same line as the backwoods folk who flock to the snake oil salesman, or is there any more to it than that? Remember, Johnny Lee Clary was with the clan, was with David Duke, and then he was with somewhat of his own clan, and he worked with me shortly until I found out he was a fat, lazy bastard and got rid of him. But he couldn't make it anywhere else. He was had been a car salesman and even a wrestler, a Hollywood-type wrestler. But he finally found his niche, got into the religious thing, got into the religious cult, and made it pretty big. Last time I saw him before he died, he was on the show with Jimmy Swaggart. Yeah, big-time stuff, man. But Jerry Lee, he's gone to meet his maker. He's going to get a big shock, I think. We cannot help but notice that most of the therapeutic rainmakers are Jews. Wow. Hubbard is the only possible exception, and a large portion are Jewish refugees from Nazi Germany or Europe. Can it be that these people have a score to settle with the Gentile society? Could it just possibly be that these Jews are getting off on getting back at the Goyim? Was Portney's complaint really such a caricature, or was it a number one on bestseller list precisely because it so vividly brought together all these characteristics which we have all been sneakily suspected might be interrelated? Further, we cannot help but take note of the salacious nature of much therapy dialogue. Toiletry and sexual terms are hurled about, not in a matter of fact or a clinical sense, but in an abusive way. The Jewish therapists take great delight in having their often sensitive clients embarrass and humiliate themselves by bandying around words which would rarely be heard at home, terms like cock, fuck, cunt, and so on. I just had a guy email me that supposedly is in the right wing, racial, and called me all these names. Anyhow, are not used in a loving, appreciative sense as they might be whispered in a lover's ear during a passionate bedroom tryst. They are used as terms of abuse, as they are in the inventory of the barracks room or the dockside or the factory floor, and the scatological terms asshole, shit, crap, and so on are not included in dialogue in a healthy Anglo-Saxon way where bodily functions would be regarded in an ecological, organic sense. It might be argued that such sexual and scatological banter has a more serious side. It is not just the therapist making sure that everyone in the group is helped to free themselves of verbal inhibitions and restraints. It is not even just that the therapist needs to let off a bit of steam. It is the way the therapist chooses to let off that steam, in abusing the clients with sexual and scatological terms. The therapist is telling more about himself or herself than he or she is about the client. The therapist is saying that he or she feels suppressed and blocked in those areas. Otherwise, what would make penises, vaginas, and stools into reference points any more than fingers, toes, or earlobes? Readers who are not privileged to live in the locales where the therapy industry is well established, chiefly Southern California and New York City, may be somewhat baffled at the continued success of all the quackery. So let us pause for a moment to consider the reasons for the public, general public continuing to support it. We can easily understand why it is that Jews flock to Jewish therapists. The therapist articulates for them all the pent-up rage and frustration that being Jewish is all about. The processes and the acting-out sessions fit snugly into the mold of Jewish ritual down through the ages. The emphasis on guilt, suffering, and torment are part and parcel of the Jewish religious and cultural life. Well, I'm saying too, right here, he doesn't say it, but I think the Christian church is just as full of this stuff. They borrowed it from the Jews. The Judaic religion is not one of love and kindness, but one of duty, sin, retribution, and cruelty. Even innocent animals are made to suffer. Cattle and sheep are strung up by their hind legs and bled to death. Shakita, the chickens are twirled around the rabbi's head in an annual sin-purging ceremony. Goats are brought into the synagogue, and all the sins of the congregation magically transferred into them, hence scapegoats. The Jews are fond of telling us that one can judge a nation's standard of civilization by how they treat their Jews. While there is much ironic truth in this aphorism, an even more universal measure might be that one can judge a nation's civilization on how they treat their animals. The Jewish faith is probably the most highly regulated religion in the world. Rabbis pore over the Talmuds and the Torahs and nitpick with each other over whether such and such passage should take precedence over some other passage. Rules and Talmudic instructions are quoted in to regulate even the tiniest aspects of Jewish life. Most of the rituals are more akin to Borneo than to Europe. Newborn infants have part of their penises chopped off in a ceremony that includes masturbation and fellatio in front of a beaming audience. Women are prohibited from entering the synagogues. They're shunned during their periods. Men strap leather thongs around their arms and prayer boxes on their foreheads. More prayers are placed in little holders on the household doorpost, a good luck charm. Food must be segregated into kosher and non-kosher, meat and dairy. Even clothes must be regulated according to their fiber content. All in all, the Jewish faith is so steeped in superstition and backward rigmarole that it is not surprising that many Jews find they have a need to express some of their frustration at all of this overregulation and disharmony and rationality. So they turn to a big brother figure in the form of a Jewish therapist. There they can be sure of some ethnic sympathy or empathy and understanding for their predicament. After all, the therapist has suffered those same torments himself. But what is it that makes Gentiles flock to Jewish therapists? European thought is supposed to be the most rational, the most objective, the most scientific as compared to the subjective anti-Hellenic synthesis of other races. Is this phenomenon unique only to those Gentiles who happen to reside in the land of fruits and nuts? Or we can trace a similar pattern of gullible in other areas, gullibility. We can note that throughout history, sound, healthy Gentile ideas have often been hijacked and corrupted by the Jews. At the beginning of Western history, healthy organic nature worship of our pagan ancestors was hijacked and turned into poisonous, bizarre cult known as Christianity. The pagan festival of life and fertility was turned completely around and became a celebration of death and necrophilia, the crucifixion of Jesus. The celebration of midwinter prosperity and vigor, Yuletide, was turned into a neurotic carnival of misogynistic sex phobia, the Christmas virgin birth. In the Middle Ages, European liberation, free enterprise, was latched onto by Jewish moneylenders and bankers and became the cruel pyramid sales scam known as capitalism. In the last century, ingenious indigenous progressive socialist ideas were stolen and poisoned by the Jewish neurotic Karl Marx and made into the terror of the Bolshevik communism. These three C's, Christianity, capitalism, and communism, represent worldwide movements where otherwise rational, intelligent Gentiles have fallen hook, line, and sinker for Jewish hype. Therapy is merely another example, though it remains to be seen whether or not it will last as long as these other scams. It may well be that therapy is destined to secede Christianity, from which therapy has lifted much of its structure, now that Christianity has outlived its usefulness in acting as a battering ram for capitalism, imperialism, and liberalism. Psychoanalysis is so much like confession that it is uncanny. The priest analyst listens intently to the confessor's sins, recommends penance, and issues of absolution. We note that Roman Catholics who practice confession much more than the other Christian cults are very much underrepresented on the analysis couch. They already have access to the same service at the church. Critical writers such as Martin L. Gross have pointed out how many therapy cults, especially the more esoteric kind, have all the hallmarks of religions, with missionary work, evangelism, a hierarchy of priests, church guardians, articles of faith, and, of course, heretics. One therapy cult, Scientology, actually calls itself a church. The level of the discussion in many of the cult sessions is similar to that of Christians pontificating about how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. In summary, then, we must conclude that the reason for Gentiles falling for Jewish therapy is the same as the reason why Gentiles fall for Jewish Christianity, Jewish capitalism, and Jewish communism. And the detailed discussion of that gullibility must be left until another book. Thank you, David McCollum. You did an excellent job, and everybody should read and reread this information. Well, that's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow on Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day. And just remember, you're a lone wolf out there, and you operate as a lone wolf, and you infiltrate. Always have your ears open, listen to conversations in a crowd, and you never know what you're going to hear if you listen closely. Like I listened to this guy in a big department store yesterday bragging about how they're ripping off the Christians, 16,000 churches, and he's living like a king, and it's wonderful, and he's trying to get his buddy into the act. Keep your pie hole shut, boys and girls. I'll be with you tomorrow. Well, I'm going to close out here with one of my favorite songs. I got a million favorite songs, but this is Johnny Paycheck. Johnny Paycheck, when he was a star, got busted, ended up doing about 10 years in the clink, and came out and started singing again. And this one, I've always had sort of a liking for this one. I'm going to close out with it.
You got a guest that's hot, too.
Is he?
And I think we ought to get him on and let him cool off some.
Tell him who he is.
I'll be glad to, ladies and gentlemen. Many people used to know him as Donnie Young, but we call him Johnny Paycheck.
Oh, yeah!
That's the stage name.
Now
him. You know who.
Woo! Good, Johnny! Yeah!
What a beautiful mansion he built you. Splendor, Lord, you got it, wall to wall. But with all of his money, he's still not happy. 'Cause every time he's gone, I get your call. Slide over your satin sheets, slip into your long soft mink. You know how to find my door, and I know what you're crying for. Slide off your satin sheets, slip into your long soft mink. You know how to find my door, and I know what you're crying for. I was good for nothing, and you couldn't live on dreams and crystal balls. Now his money buys you everything but my loving, so I guess I'm good for something after all. Slide off your satin sheets, slip into your long soft mink. You know how to find my door, now I know what you're crying for. Slide off your satin sheets, slip into your long soft mink.